Hello all, and welcome to another episode of Fueled by Charcoal, a podcast where artists openly speak on burnout, inspiration, and their creative process. I'm your host, Connor Saffron, jack of all trades, master of some, and today I am joined by Victoria Priano. Vic, how would you describe yourself as a creative?
I am an illustrator and a talent rep working within the beauty and entertainment industry.
So we're longtime creative compatriots, bestest buddy. I don't know how often we actually delve into what we do, aside from projects we're actively working on. What would a quick history of things that you are most proud of having worked on, walk us through that?
I feel like point of pride doesn't necessarily mean done, and I think that's going to be 100%. Highlighted in large portion of this. I guess client-wise, Dungeons & Dragons, Wedgwood, Diptyque, Chaosium, and World of Darkness have been some of my bigger projects that I'm proud of.
So a lot of work within the TTRPG space.
Tabletop role-playing and luxury activation.
Mm. So before we delve into the focus, ultimately, Fueled by Charcoal is about burnout and our relationship to burnout, because I feel like both you and I have a very unique kind of relationship with our own personal creative, self-distance. Where do you think was the starting point where you started to engage with your own creativity?
Starting point in relation to when I started making work?
Yeah, where was your professional start, I guess?
When I was about 22, I got a back cover opportunity from Marvel. A little bit before that, I was working with Top Cow and a few of the more emerging options as far as when you graduate from School of Visual Arts, comics appointment. There's a lot of feeding art directors and things to go for. And so I think that's the start. I am much more proud, I guess, of the work I did with local bands and more poster and flyer stuff. But as far as work for hire, I definitely think that the big comics people were prominent ones. But more importantly to me, I think just drawing kind of low effort posters and illustrations for bands that I was playing with, but also around, was definitely much more creatively invigorating.
So kind of the hard cut question here, the focus is, I feel when it came to the core focus of this podcast is how we work despite burnout, in spite of burnout. I feel like I've had a creative reset two or three times. I've described it as the anxiety phoenix, where I will hit a point where I've reached utter burnout and I look elsewhere for a means of creative expression. I've gone from when I was much younger drawing to photography and eventually coming back to writing. What was your first major experience with creative distance and more just full-scale burnout?
My first experience with full-scale burnout was I used to draw comics, volumes and volumes of comics, starting at the age of about 6. And then when I became about 13 or 14, I started really making friends. Mm. So I started to view it as kind of a trade-off. It's I either can have a massive social life where people really accept me and like me, or I could be isolated and doubt myself. So I guess the conventional answer to where the burnout starts is it felt like a trade-off of, if you want to be a person and outside, you can't really make art. So I started to villainize it. And so every single time I was in my own little world, I started to be hey, well, I have this massive internal world. Why can't I have this outside? So I started to kind of resent what I had while I was alone as an artist. Mm. And that sort of created the first, I guess, planted the first bad seed in my association with reoccurring and chronic, in some ways, burnout, because it's less, oh, something just makes me exhausted in a medium, and it's more the trade-off of isolation and value placement as an artist and how that shapes out in social ways, as it shapes out in mental health ways, and ultimately in the way that, like, we see ourselves and value ourselves as people.
It really does feel like a tipping of scales where you have to prioritize your creative output over any kind of major social interaction. We both use the spoons metaphor. Where we place our energy, definitely. I don't feel like it should feel like we have to make that decision between creative engagement and social engagement, but there really is a hard line between those two, isn't there?
It's dependent on the medium. Not to be contrarian in any sort of way, but, like, if you are writing, people are hearing your words and have much more of an easy way to parasocially latch on to either your prose or the personality that you're putting outward. With illustration, it feels like a little bit more of a locked cage or a private residency where a few people, like, will know the passcode to getting in there, but it becomes a lot more lonely. And then I feel as though with mediums like tabletop role-playing games, it kind of exists in kind of a vacuum where it is, even by design, pro-social, but there's still a layer in there that prevents it from being a sincere, like, vulnerable. It can be vulnerable, but it's still a performance. So, like, I guess I kind of jump around a lot between what mediums allow that extension. And I'm also somebody that struggles very deeply with black and white thinking. I'll admit to it now. It very much ends up being, I am this and nothing else. And so I feel like the balance factor is almost what burns me out in regard to that.
It's interesting that just thinking on, like, TTRPGs in a creative mindset, when it came to my own, like, writing burnout, I, for a couple of years, just was not engaged with any of my creative focuses or mediums. And it was returning to TTRPGs, and that first major stepping out of a collaborative writing process, you know, out of the pan into the fire, and, like, just kind of having that sudden realization, like, I am writing this character, but because of the nature of the game and the nature of, you know, not 100% of the table, but definitely certain members of a table, being able to try to play off of that kind of, you know, rekindled the spark. TTRPGs definitely are a more collaborative space. Do you think that that collaboration is, do you think it reinforces the cage, or do you think that it inspires more opportunity for kind of branching out to kind of fuse that social and creative output?
I feel like the experience of sitting at a table and playing a tabletop role-playing game is very conducive to pro-social behavior. I feel as though any sort of group that has a capacity to homogenize and not challenge one another, but support one another, ultimately stops being helpful to the group that's participating in it and starts to either become derivative and an echo chamber of either taste or values that then become in itself a subculture that has a lot of halo effect around it. I find that my biggest association with burnout, as ironic as it is the social groups and communities I end up finding myself in as a result of doing X medium, and how I will get burnt out with inflexibility and just certain behaviors that happen within small groups, specifically online. And as the two mediums I mostly worked in and have also in a lot of ways distanced myself from here and there, I find that something can go from being incredibly pro-social to many, many reporters starting to create content about the death of social media and how it just doesn't feel as flexible or community-driven as it did before. So then it becomes, do I go outside?
I'm
sorry about the framing of that.
I agree with that.
Honestly, it should be a lot of different things, and I'm very hopeful for individuals, but I find that hang-ups happen when there's a really strong belief that you're the debaser, that there's some edgy kid doing the thing that's harder and everybody else is normies. And with comics and with tabletop role-playing games, there is a massive amount of community the really strong belief that that is the case.
Yeah, as much as I like to laud TTRPGs as like this collaborative, you know, the mecca of like, it's your halfway point to therapy and creative expression. It's really one of the, it's a space that is so heavily defined by its gatekeeping. And then in and of itself, you get, I'm not sure if it's just like the hangers-on then, you know, institute themselves as like the industry standard. And then that like influx of, I mean, for lack of a better term, normies, just trying to create an industry within the space then kind of devolve to this like just a group of shills trying to capitalize on what is otherwise a very sincere space.
I don't think it's shills. I think it's people trying really hard to have a sense of community and struggling when people disagree with them. Mm. And it also, like, I think a problem or an issue that comes up a lot in this is because so much of it is online, that a lot of parasocial relationships are formed that aren't actually social. Because, like, when you're playing a game with somebody, you're playing a game with their character. And unless you take the time to be like, hey, I want to know you as a person outside of this, you need to remember what the boundaries of that certain thing is.
Yeah.
And so, as we kind of, like, framed it initially with the, what's the first burnout that happened? To go back to, like, a 13, 14-year-old perspective, it's, I just wanted to be able to create the thing, but also, like, just be around and be fun.
Yeah.
And it's difficult for a lot of people to just kind of hang out. And I mean that online, too.
Yeah.
But
I mean, especially as we've gotten older and the world has become what it has, trying to dedicate time for just pure and simple joy, or extremely complex joy. Let's not limit, because ultimately, what is a TTRPG but adding rules and mechanics to the concept of a shared delusion? On the note of how you've engaged with your burnout, because I've known you for a long time. You are an extremely talented illustrator, and it's medium that you're returning to. What was the, it might not be something as quantifiable as like, what are the steps to, you know, falling back in love with your medium, but how did you come back to wanting to push your more personal creative output as a priority?
It's definitely not a push. It's definitely not a priority.
Okay.
I'd say it's a coincidental homecoming in some ways. I think my initial approach was, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm not having any fun.
Mm.
And if I never do it again, that is totally fine. And actually accepting that, and accepting the idea that this thing that had floated me for nearly 3 decades might not be all that I am. And there might be a whole part of me that I haven't been able to explore as a result of just honing in on one particular medium. Mm. And just taking a step back and being like, what if I'm not an artist? What if it's more important for people to just see me as a person and not expect a certain piece of work out of it, or a certain line of, oh, can you draw this for me for this? It'd be really cool. I felt as though just going off of social media and deleting everything, and it no longer being a conversation with people I hadn't met asking me for content, I think it allowed me to be like, do I want to go back to this? Does this give me joy? But instead of going back, it was more, do I move forward in a way where I can use this tool and enjoy it? It's more like, did I yearn for it? I guess it's not a, oh, it's almost like falling in love in a way. It's like it became an incredibly abusive relationship as a result of a bunch of external factors that weren't necessarily about the people within the relationship, just expectations, bad friend group.
There are a couple of points I want to touch on.
Unlivable work conditions.
Yeah. So definitely, I understand when it comes to the struggle of identifying yourself as an artist, when it comes to what is the productivity of your output and what do you affiliate your art with? Because it seems like you want your illustration to be a much more personal representation of yourself, and maybe something that you share with the people you're closest to, But at the same time, you know, when you were presenting yourself as a professional in the space, there was this expectation that became more of a weight than it was worth.
I enjoy doing the work alone and like really just enjoy the process of it. I don't necessarily think it means anything to me to like make my work. I don't think there's necessarily an emotional tether to like enjoying drawing necessarily. I think it's more that the idea and concept of being an artist is built up in so many of the ways that you just described, actually, where it becomes like, this is a personal aspect of me. This is me. And like, it's for people I care about. It's really not. It was a job and it stopped being fun because people thought as a vehicle, my work was X, or that there was a halo effect around everything. So it stopped being about just the thing that I did and put out there and started being about like a perception of how I am. And like, as you just said, a much more personal representation of myself, but like that wasn't really for them, nor was it for the performance of content. It's kind of just like, these are just drawings. It's not that deep. And
I feel like
all of it's exhausting.
Yeah. I also, just from my own experience, I divorce the idea so inherently of what it is to be an artist from creative output, because if we were going purely by published works, I am a nubile wee baby child. I have so little work that still exists in a physical or digital form. You know, we all went through that age of like, okay, no, burn the journal. And I feel like I've definitely had more of it when it came to my own burnout. I've had a way more destructive kind of relationship with my former work. And this new avenue of expression is definitely a different priority. But I think that an artist is an artist despite whether or not there is proof of their work. Being an artist is a perspective.
But what is the value of being an artist? Like, what do you get out of that identity and the association with output of that identity?
From my perspective, I think that the value in identifying as an artist is, it really is just like a label that denotes perspective more than anything. And I think that creative output and following, utilizing your skill set or your perspective in a professional context is secondary. I think the value in output is ultimately art, and any expression is a communication between art and artist, is the artist and audience. It is this beautiful synchronistic knot in, you know, a tether in time and space and all of these mystical ideas. But ultimately, it's conveying a message into a medium. And then even if it's not exactly the message that is received, that established communication, that communication in and of itself is the inherent value of one's output. Okay. The ability to inspire. Because I think that I am especially guilty of hyperfixation and reading into subtext, maybe messages that aren't necessarily even there, but by looking in for deeper themes that may have not been intended but can be perceived, there's additional value in a work.
So in making art, the value that's important for you is for it to be inspirational, as well as be a conduit for creating community and building relationships.
Maybe not even established relationships in a reciprocal sense, but by throwing a claim of the self into the void and having that be reciprocated, even if the reciprocation is never received. The pessimist in me wants to, you know, cut down my own thought as this idea that any form of artist is inherently a narcissist and they want to leave their mark on the world that will outlast them. But I think that, again, it's this daisy chain of inspiration, of igniting, even, you know, beyond intention, igniting that spark in those who are willing to receive it and those who are able to reciprocate that feeling.
So would it be possible to say that from your perspective, burnout kind of happens because it's a transaction in which you want there to be a spark or an inspiration, And then when it's not there over a large period of time, you want to disengage with the process of making that work.
I feel like that's fair to say. I also think that the energy that goes into expression is inherently taxing. Mm-hmm. Definitely, I think that the toll that expression and creative expression especially is increased when there's an expectation of reciprocation and there is none.
Okay.
So to continue on the idea of your relationship with burnout, how does your current work relate to your past work? And
I represent artists within beauty and the commercial industry, which is a lot of entertainment related representation. I would say that working with artists as an artist, it kind of allows you to be a biologist in the sense that you're kind of just taking yourself and everybody else apart, but you have a different set of tools to put things back together and to make opportunities. So like you get to kind of analyze from a much more anthropological versus journalistic perspective why in the past you've dealt with certain shortcomings or certain insecurities or certain like, oh, I can't do this. And seeing the other side of the email, it's like, well, it's simply because somebody else got it. It's not a matter of like you being more valuable, or it's a matter of you being very excessive or being on top of things too much and learning to slow down. And it becomes much more of a game than, and it stops being as emotional. And I think that was really a missing piece for me, to be able to understand how it works and understand what gets, having a broad spectrum of people getting in their own way about certain things and being able to kind of,
I can imagine that your experience of getting in your own way has kind of helped facilitate, you know, bridging that gap for your representation.
It's also made me realize I'm significantly less dramatic than I thought I was in the past.
I think
like there are times where I'm like, oh, I'm being a diva. And I'm like, wait until you represent makeup artists for a living.
I think there's definitely a history that there's a past that exists where we were both the theater kids we thought we were.
And
the
world is a much different place.
That, neither was I.
I have never a single day in my life been a theater kid. You into the tragedies.
But do you think that by helping to bridge that gap for people and to make those connections with your own experience and building that baseline for who you represent, do you think that has helped facilitate your own creative return?
I feel as though it's made me realize that I really like the people I talk to a lot more in this industry. And I'm willing to come to the table a lot more with them. And as a result, I've gotten opportunities to draw things within the spaces that the artists I represent do not fill. And I find that it made me recognize that a lot of the problems I was facing and a lot of the walls that I came up against were actually a lack of creativity from other people. And that's a weird thing to say out loud, because yeah. I feel like artists to be more creative about the world outside of their work. And it's like, oh, I would never want to draw for a fashion magazine, and then they'll create a whole argument about how it's below them and they're really nuts and bolts and they have, like, they would never do that. It would be a sellout situation. And there's a lot of lore building that occurs in the illustration vectors and communities I occupied for most of a decade and a half that really like limit a lot of people's careers, because they'll be like, oh, I would never do this. I actually, about a year ago, somebody had reached out to me because they wanted to just like get to know me more and for us to like just talk about our own experiences. And they'd come on hard times and they were looking for like job leads. And during the conversation, I had suggested like activations, which I had been doing for like just sitting for several hours, painting, doing watercolors for a guest in a boutique fragrance store. And they scoffed at that. And they're like, I would never do it. That's not art for me. But this is a matter of being able to survive.
Yeah,
live.
Like, and I feel like especially in the current day and age, not to immediately fall into current year argument for everything, but I feel like the concept of being a sellout is so, it's so apropos of just like a self-imposed dire straits. It like, you pay the rent. If you can pay the
rent.
You
don't have to start to be an artist.
Yeah. I think that.
That's why I was so critical about the identifying factors and being like, that's why I was asking so many of those questions.
Yeah.
It's like, where is the subculture and where is the, because like you'd be saying you would be romanticizing a lot of it, but you'd also be using words like output and productivity.
It's like, strange because I am trying to,
bro.
Yeah. It's a very odd blend of vernacular when, you know, I've been entrenching myself recently in the more professional aspects of things, looking into potential careers in publishing. And because, you know, I feel like the old adage of those who cannot do teach is a anti-education bit of propaganda.
Oh, I agree with that entirely.
And I think that, like, ultimately, if you want to be a creative person, there is no better way. I applaud traditional education, but especially when it comes to art, especially when it comes to the American perspective, it's very difficult to bleed the stone of a valuable education from a creative standpoint. So the next best place to take on that role of paving the way forward for those who come after you is in facilitating production. Looking at a job that will pay the bills, if you can get into a space as an acquisitions editor, you can make the things you want to see exist, even if you're not the one making them. And I think there's some kind of inherent value in that.
And I also feel as though like there is an archetype and a stereotype of the almost the like Hemingway, I just drink and I live in a log cabin by myself.
I recently may have also had the Ralph Waldo Emerson and also Walden, like, maybe we could just embrace nature and enjoy art and produce things and not worry
about it. I've always had a more Hunter S. Thompson.
I love people who can have more of a Hunter S. Thompson gonzo perspective on things.
No, it's not a positive thing.
No, I know it's not a positive thing. It's
critiquing myself on this.
It is a very toxic place to live in. It is not conducive to healthy living.
I think that emerging into seeing what the potential of actual community could be like and not caring if somebody is a artist and not caring what they do, but like if you get along with them and just trying to build that relationship, you find a lot more opportunities for yourself. And I find that there's very insular pockets, especially on the internet. Going back to the conversation I had had with that young woman, she was just kind of like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do any of this. I just want to do my own thing and it'll work out. And I'm like, then why did I buy you coffee? If I had known I was consulting a teenager, I would have just stayed home. And it really reinforced like my grief I have for different mediums. And when we're talking about the idealized artist and like the person that we look up to, that's actually what's changed a lot of my relationship with my own work and the work I want to create. Because it used to be very much like, oh, I like this person's work and I just want to work really hard. And then when I was about, I must have been like 23 years old, I met one of my heroes. They just like told me how lonely and sad they were about like how little people they knew outside of in the space that they occupied and how they always felt like they were drowning. And like kind of go back to the answer of like how healthy things can become. Like a friend of mine actually passed away within the last couple of years, and his death made me kind of be like, you know, what if it's okay to just do a little art as a treat again? Because I would rather be happy at a coffee shop working for minimum wage and having people just smile and strangers from all sorts of different like jobs, backgrounds, fintech, just having all sorts of all different, literally anyone coming in for a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
Than be in the homogenized self-martyring space that often exists online within the games and hobbyist realm.
Yeah. That kind of is a good point of synchronicity for a couple of things, because ultimately finding new founts of inspiration is how we move forward. And when it comes to those who are our personal artist heroes or inspirations, it's hard to look anywhere but to Lynch. When I watched The Art Life for the first time, I think that really did shake me for a lot of the archetypical ideas of what an artist is.
Okay.
It is the enjoyment of the work is what defines an artist, at least according to Lynch. Mm-hmm. And that suffering can, you know, be a part of one's creative expression. But, you know, Van Gogh may have cut off his ear, but he probably enjoyed painting. And that's why he continued to paint, even when he was in such a dire mental state. I guess, firstly, if you had to turn to one particular fount of inspiration, one like personal creative hero, who would that be, and for what reason?
So about 3 months ago, my dad said that he wrote poems before he had me. And I think that it would definitely be my dad. I have not read any of the poems. I tried to get him to join all sorts of poetry writing workshops since he's mentioned that to me. And he's like, I don't have time. I'm living. I'm doing all of that. But I feel like it's not just my dad. It's people who have a willingness to support art, make sure that it's made.
Yeah.
More than it is people who actively live the life of artists. And I feel like the patron that stands for the true opportunity of the artist is much more impactful than any particular one artist at any point in my life.
Yeah.
But I would also be like, it's Ursula K. Le Guin. But that's because she was an incredibly well-rounded person. I would say the exact same thing. It's Octavia Butler and Ursula K. Le Guin, because they were both phenomenal women. They were phenomenal people that also just so happened to be phenomenal writers. But the way that they separately viewed themselves and their journey are both shining examples of pro-social, humanist, big-hearted people that just want to be able to exist and share what they had. I'm trying to find the motivational notes to self from Octavia Butler. It goes viral like nearly every summer for whatever reason. I shall be a best-selling writer. After I am, each of my books will be on the bestsellers list of all of the things that have now collapsed. My novels will go on above list, whether publishers push them hard or not, whether I'm paid a high advance or not, whether I ever win another award or not. This is my life. I write selling novels. My novels go on to bestseller list. It's to want to exist in both your imagined world and the real world at the same time, and not to make the compromise between one or the other.
Yeah.
I feel like there's a lot of very dangerous and violent people out there that choose to exist in a very deluded reality of fantasy that are causing it to be really hard for anybody who wants to be an artist existing both within the world that they've created for themselves and in the world that actually exists. And so I feel like it's not just one artist. It's not just one person that hasn't written a poem in 32 years. Also, he might be writing them and I just don't know about it. And he just doesn't share them with me, which would break my heart. But it's people who want to actively show up for the world that's actually in front of them, and also build upon the world that exists within themselves that provides them comfort when the outside world is just a lot.
Yeah.
And for it to kind of be okay to occupy both.
I think that that really is the undertow for the romanticism behind Emersonian transcendentalism, or at least it was for me a couple of years ago. Because it's not just about, you know, God in the world around us as the, you know, the surface level understanding of that movement would portray. It's about facilitating creativity. Although one note I did want to touch on, because to very different mediums, we are kind of the children of creatives. You followed and work with your dad representing artists. Both my parents are creatives in the more practical sense. My family had an event decoration and coordination business for years that my dad was spearheading. And my mom's been a florist for most of her life. So while I'm not within that same realm of creativity, I felt like there is this idea of legacy and creativity almost. Do you feel mm-hmm. like that is a burden or an inspiration?
I feel like it's neither in a way. And I love how I was like, I have black and white thinking, and yet I have a third answer for everything. I would say it is an additional tool and an additional skill. And that's why in case of people who are billionaires who have children, it becomes nepotism. But in the case of the rest of us, it becomes, oh, I can see the world from a different perspective.
Yeah.
That doesn't just go in a very linear way. And I like that. I like to use the term legacy a lot, because even if it's not the same medium or anything like that, just seeing proof that somebody can survive and make an okay life for themselves purely out of creative pursuit is an incredibly valuable experience that does place people in a position of elevation and honestly privilege. Because if you're able to have seen it without having to just imagine it, it makes it a lot easier. Also, like in a lot of cases, people who have succeeded in the past, what's her name? Hannah Einbinder. Hmm. Her mother was one of the original writers and actors on SNL. And her show Hacks, and even in the way that she like navigates the platform, like perfect example of like both nepotism and legacy, because like she is a queer woman who has ADHD and was like just working in a coffee shop for most of her 20s. And then decided, like, always comedy was an interest of hers. She goes into it in one of these interviews, but like, it's interesting to hear even the luckiest people who got the most also that it's a skill.
Yeah.
It's a skill to have a privilege and a lucky kind of, it's invaluable to have seen or be brought up by somebody who is able to succeed in their creative pursuits. And I find it's devastating for so many people who have to create that within themselves entirely. And there's a lot of harm and a lot of pain that comes from that. And sometimes that pain becomes too exhausting to want to do it for a living anymore.
I think the guiding line between nepotism and legacy is just the sincerity. I mean, I feel like the defining difference between products of nepotism and products of legacy is the sincerity of their work.
I feel like it has everything to do with capitalism.
Yeah, I mean, for every Max Landis, there's someone who deserves to be successful.
Oh, no, what I'm saying is the specific difference between the terms nepotism and legacy is capitalism.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
You could use the term dynasty as well, but that conflates things and makes it more confusing and kind of sits between the definitions of both those things.
Yeah. So when it comes to how I don't think we have moved past our burnout. I think that we have embraced the parts of ourselves that have been burnt out, and we continue to, you know, burn on. The idea of being fueled by charcoal is that what is charcoal but just heat-treated wood to become a more efficient source of fuel. What are some of practices or rituals that you've adopted to help facilitate a more healthy creative balance without burning out too hard?
It's hard to burn out when you have a better life. And I've been, so a friend of mine just got a corporate job after being a content creator for 9 years. Mm-hmm. She was talking about how nice it is to just be around people instead of in front of a ring light. And I think the most rewarding thing, because I think of burnout more as like just a sign that your body needs a break and not like some inevitable like, oh, I'm just burnt out, I have writer's block. I've never been prescriptive to any of those things.
Yeah.
It's been more that like, I feel like when your body's like, I can't do this anymore, and you actually have the possibility to pause. And if you feel like you don't have the possibility to pause, then it's less burnout and it's more something's just not working and you need to like find a way to make it work so that you do have that creative outlet back. And a lot of people will bring up how, oh, I'm selling out by taking up a few shifts as a barista, or I'm selling out by working to sell lottery tickets, or I'm going against everything people view me as by going and working in the corporate sector. And I feel like the artist in that case is then defined by their audience. And it becomes a lot easier to have the sensation of burnout because you're on a stage and you're not checking in with your body.
Yeah.
And or you might not have the ability to. And I feel like the long-winded of answer of that is it's not a source of fuel. It's making sure like the engine's running properly.
Yeah, definitely.
And like whatever that furnace is doesn't have like I keep thinking of trains and I'm not going into the train thing right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, I feel like it's less so
there's
like,
broken tracks.
Yeah.
And we need to stop things.
And maybe that the systematic them. Idea of a one way like force.
And maybe in a bakery in the middle of Times Square for 3 months and everyone thinks you're losing your mind, but you're totally okay because you're allowed to be things outside of your art. You're allowed to just be a person. And I feel like that's the thing that you're talking about, the resentment people have towards teachers specifically when they're like, oh, if you can't do, you teach.
Yeah.
But that comes from teachers that will grind you into the ground and tell you you're fucking awful at everything and you have no value if you're not able to do life drawings or something in your like sophomore year of college and didn't have a long-standing result on your views of yourself at all.
It might be a step out of order, but you did have a creative education and I'm pursuing secondary creative education. How do you think that framework has either helped or hindered you? I do want to return to the former point, because to make a quick note, I think the idea, the visualization of, you know, being fueled by our own burnout is less so like a train engine to me and more of a bonfire. It's just okay. What you use to make it last, and it's to provide your own warmth. And I feel like when it comes to the professional industries that occur, you know, across the board, the idea of the train engine is a much more applicable one, where because people are trying to follow a set path formed by systematic malice because it is the only way.
But like, how is it formed by systematic malice? Who, like, is the systemic malice just society, or is it like just people wanting stable jobs? That's what I'm getting at.
Yeah,
here.
Like, I think that, I mean, the undercurrent
of the framework of that.
I think the framework of it is, you know, Edgar Allan Poe died penniless and drug addled in the streets.
Yeah, but he also like was had one a crush of the, on his sister and had all sorts of issues going on right there.
Okay, maybe Poe's not their best. I mean, there's a lot of people who aren't recognized in their own time.
Use the example of the guy writing the story about bricking someone into a wall. That sounds real healthy.
I mean,
Edgar Allan Poe, best author to use.
Had problems. No, but I feel
because
like
he was so locked into his identity and the romanticism and the result of all this grief and death that became the entirety of like his body of work, because he was just constantly living in the post-traumatic reality of just being fucked over by every single person in his life.
Yeah.
And then he got super sick. It's like, this wasn't a train he could get off of. He had a publisher that abused him. He had all sorts of horrible things happening because it's kind of related to what we were saying. He was just an artist.
Yeah, I think that's the core of it.
And he was just creative. He was mentally ill as a result.
Yes. The path to success, or what we acknowledge as success fiscally, is one of cruelty, at least from the outset. When it comes to my own works and my own goals, if I make my creative spark was ignited by or reignited by looking for something and not finding it and realizing that there is an inherent responsibility in those who can to create that what they lack. And my metric for success is if I have a single person ever read anything I put out and reciprocate that spark of inspiration, I don't care what, you know, the money coming in would be from whatever property that is, that is the self-actualization. That is the fulfillment. That is the bar, is reciprocating that spark in one other person. I've made it. But when it comes down to being a professional creative, what we determine, or what society determines as successful, is vast and hypocritical and under various imperceivable metrics that become outdated as they are established.
I also feel as though a lot of what is taught and a lot of what is said kind of rejects the concept of embracing joy.
Yeah.
And as a result, a lot of, you use the term self-actualized and fulfillment specifically, but you made it the 1-to-1 ratio of, oh, if a person receives this and understands it, do you feel as though if you were to have a conversation with somebody, you would experience the same level of fulfillment if it was about conveying the same message?
I'm not sure that it even has to be an understanding of the intended message, but just, again, I think it's about joy. I think if I can spark that joy in someone, and it's conductive, and it goes back to another Lynch quote from The Art Life, where negativity is the antagonist of creativity. And we think of the suffering artist as like the default trope. And we all condemn each other over the ability to pay our bills by calling work that we otherwise might not be proud of as a creative, you know, selling out. Ultimately, it is that want to spark joy outside of myself.
Okay.
That's the drive, at least for me, for now. What is an identifiable core to your creative drive that you tried to nurture? Or
I feel like the creativity is the drive. So it's more just how can I survive being me? and it's the act of being creative and finding ways to just exist where and how my brain works.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to be like nihilistic in any way.
I mean, it's hard to not be nihilistic. The malaise.
I don't have a drive.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I don't think we need to even confine it to the idea of drive, because the forward momentum is great when it comes to getting through the work as long as you're enjoying it. But I feel like even limiting, you know, that
but even that is so clinical and industrial.
Yeah. It's so strange trying to put a framework to this amalgam.
No, I'm a terrorist in this regard.
No, it is like, I am going to continue to quote Lynch until the day I die. And I'm going to continue to reference Lynch. But like, it is this Lynchian, like, just vague, ethereal malaise of understanding or of not understanding and evoking emotion. And drive puts that into a box. And, you know, it's Schrodinger's creativity. It's, you know, it's either dead inside or it's not. Ultimately, the box is at fault.
You ever, I think it's called daily rituals, maybe. So yes, it is daily rituals. In daily rituals, there is a section for David Lynch, and it brings up how every day, whenever he's going to work, he went down to the diner and had a milkshake and coffee and a milkshake and coffee and a milkshake and coffee. And that was just his thing.
Yep. And he would write things out on napkins.
I feel as though trying to be procedural versus anecdotal is part of what kind of mucks up the gears. Mm. And just like finding a joy in kind of like the mundane is a lot easier than the romanticizing of the craft. The drive comes from wanting to continue and less about wanting to produce.
Yeah.
And I feel like to answer that, then, the drive is to want to continue and to want to be curious and want to have an interest in work. Not in work. I don't even like the word work.
Yeah.
And just communication and having joy in the conversation and being excited about the things you can share and communicate and experience the thoughts of other people. That
joy in the act of doing.
Even that I hate.
Or not doing, even. It's just I fully agree with you.
No more doing.
The continued perspective. Because I definitely think in the deepest set of my burnout, I was not thinking creatively. I was not existing in a creative perspective. And it was to my detriment. And I feel like
feel as though the weight of you not existing as quote unquote creative contributed to the possible definitions of what that burnout is.
Yes. And I feel like that's where the concept of return to form as the anxiety phoenix of like, okay, I have burned to ashes. And if I'm going to continue to exist, I must burn brighter, despite the impossibility of it all.
So do you think a ritual or a habit would help you to establish a consistent line of wanting to continue?
Yes.
Because there's this quote from Octavia Butler, actually, which is, first, forget inspiration. Habit is more dependable. Habit will sustain you, whether you're inspired or not. So by continuing to live and not caring what is the definition of creating or being creative and existing within the way that your brain kind of works, aren't you kind of just doing the work already?
I think that's a good perspective to have.
I work on it. I try. It's not my perspective. Perspective I'd like to adopt and create a habit of.
It's something that is an ideal I would love to implement if I can, if I can get the old gears to shed enough for us to keep moving in that direction.
I feel like with the metaphor of like a phoenix, you're just being reborn again and you're just like born sexy yesterday kind of situation. Mm. But with the idea of like continuing and evolving and changing and not just resetting your form, you're giving yourself more of an opportunity to find a different lynch in a different media, to find something else that kind of it's just joyful that you haven't really found yet.
And as someone who's, spread themselves across multiple mediums and kind of has not come back from the burnout of one or the other, it's like, even though Lynch is known for his direction and his televised and movie works, like ultimately, as an artist, just I think more than anything, it's the perspective that he imparted in his work, regardless of what it was, is what people remember him for.
Yeah.
So with the perspective that you have now, if you could have imparted a message to a past self, to a younger self, what is a message you would convey that you think would subvert some of that suffering?
Stop being so self-obsessed. Mm. Stop being obsessed with yourself. Like, be more interested in other people. Like, everybody is going through, like, everybody has hormones going in and out of their body. Everybody has some element of pain or suffering. And, like, I feel like it was really harmful when somebody said in a writing workshop early on in college, it wasn't even the part of myself I'm responding to now, but they're like, stop thinking your stories are interesting. Nobody's story is interesting. And I strongly disagree. And I think absolutely everybody's story is interesting.
Yeah.
While I felt that way as a reader, I felt like I couldn't see that as a writer. And I feel like as children, we have this really powerful ability to really just observe people, and everything around us is kind of just telling us to like look into ourselves and like be obsessed with all of these changes and all these like, oh no, I'm going through the universal experience of just being a hot ass mess. And I feel like that sentiment is more just stop romanticizing your process and your point of view and just start observing more people. Because the most fundamental thing for me is just observation without a need to get credit or like money from it, just to be able to accurately observe and learn from those things. And for there not to be a finished product that benefits an institution outside of knowledge is a really difficult pursuit in general. Mm-hmm. I would have, the younger advice to myself is, and we're talking like 10, or just be more of an anthropologist than a crybaby.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Problem. Not that you're a crybaby. That we should all be anthropologists. Oh, I am a
crybaby. No. There is duality to man. This is not black and white. Nor am I a better anthropologist. I feel like it's a constant cycle of like getting super distracted by yourself and an obsessive need to have this very unified, clear sense of identity with all of your parts. And I feel like, not to be very big picture about it, but like one of the most heartbreaking things to think about is how during the pandemic, like so many of us spent so much time just recording and staring at ourselves.
Yeah.
And really investing in this like narcissistic kind of play of getting lost. I think it's ironic how often people are called narcissists now, because like a lot of people aren't. And it's just, we kind of became in some ways our own captors to our attention, everything. And I can't help but think that primitive desire to want to be around more people wasn't performative at all. Like, we actually just watched Eddington by Ari Aster, and I was like reading all these critiques from it, and it seemed like people were just upset that he was kind of laughing at how ridiculous we became during that period of time.
Yeah,
in a lot of ways, because yeah, like there's a lot of choices that were made that are chuggy, as people like to say. And not pro-social. And I think a lot for me to be a good artist and to experience less burnout, it is to kind of like put being an artist on the shelf and just trying your best to enjoy being a person.
Yeah, ultimately, it is not some acquired title to be an artist. It is just a perspective. You are still a person, and you have to engage with being a person to be an artist, because one precludes the other.
And that's also why I'm not so like against when like content creators are like, I'm a creative, because I'm like, yeah, you're just shooting this all yourself. You have all your ring lights. You have to edit this all yourself. Like,
yep,
you go. Like, you technically, like, you're just not in the way. Like, people always fear technology. There's always a pushback of what that's defined as. And I'm not saying this about AI. I'm saying this about the earlier iteration of being like Photoshop. I remember went on the scene.
The onset of even the proliferation of Instagram filters was such a turnoff to me, because at the time I was working in a film lab, and I'm like, well, if the thing's just going to do all this work for me, what's the point? And it's going to look like shit anyway, and I'm not going to get what I want.
But what is the point? What's the point?
The point is in the joy of doing. And it took a long time for me to get that. And it took a long time of me not having access to a film lab to really recognize and appreciate.
It's just expensive.
It's extremely expensive. As much as we like to think of the psychological blocks, there are also the practical, fiscal, and societal barriers to entry when it comes to pursuing one's own creative. I'm trying not to use the word drive.
I think we frame it way too much to be a pursuit, and not enough of just letting it be the little things.
Yeah, we all can and should pursue our own, we shouldn't pursue. We should just embrace the creativity that we can.
I don't know. That sounds real woo-woo.
It is a little woo-woo.
I don't know woo-woo.
it's so hard. I love the romanticism of it all, and I love the mysticism.
I think the romanticism is what's burnt you out.
Yes. I have this tendency of exclusively destructive relationships when it comes to romanticism, but we're doing better.
That's all we can do. A little better every day.
Yep.
To survive each day a little bit. And as Dale Cooper is prone to saying, a little treat.
Every day, once a day, get yourself a
every
present.
Every day, once a day.
Don't plan it. Just let it happen.
Yes.
And again, these little things that just resonate So, Vic, my bestest buddy, thank you so much for hanging out and engaging in a very fun and silly conversation. And
Very silly.
Very silly, very deep as well. Is there anything that you're working on that you would like to share? Not necessarily as a means for social media engagement, because I know that that's... Is there a project that you're excited about right now?
Yes. The project I'm excited about is... I have a bunch of stories that I've sat on for a while, but I want to do a chapbook again soon. But it'll happen when it happens. I'm no longer like, this is released. I have options lined up for it, but it's just more... I like the era of just existing and not like a year of rest and relaxation, although I like your other books. It's more just, I'm looking forward to tomorrow. And that's what I'm currently putting out there. That's what I'm publicizing tomorrow. It'll be major tomorrow somewhere. Just enjoying daily rituals and practice.
Yeah. It's good advice, is find a ritual and commit to it.
I wake up. I'm trying to wake up at 5 a.m. from now on.
Oh, gosh. I'm going to sleep at 5 a.m. That's crazy.
But it hasn't happened yet. It's happened for my fiance, but not me. Mm. So work in progress and process, too.
Yes.
So we'll get there when we get there.
And like that is the underlying message. You know, get there at your own pace and just keep on keeping on. And
yeah.
Charcoal will keep your fire burning. But again, I would love to thank you for having this conversation with me today. And you, dear listener, the fourth wall is broken. I appreciate you sharing your time with us today. And if you found anything in today's discussion meaningful, or you know someone this episode might resonate with, consider sharing it. But yeah, Vic, really appreciate your time.
Alrighty.